Welcome to Health Styles. This is Barbara Glickstein. You're tuned into WBAI. Health Styles is here every Thursday evening at 11 p.m., produced by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. You can find out more about the center at our blog, centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. My guest is Eileen O'Grady. She has her doctorate, and she's a nurse practitioner, certified nurse practitioner, and wellness coach. She's practiced primary care for over two decades and holds three graduate degrees from George Washington University and George Mason University in nursing as well as public health, and a PhD in nursing. She currently serves as a visiting professor at Pace University in Manhattan, where she teaches wellness coaching and health policy to the next generation of nurse practitioners. She writes a monthly column on wellness at the policy level in Nurse Practitioner World News and has authored numerous books, book chapters, and articles, and has a busy public speaking calendar. She resides in Washington, D.C., and I'm very pleased to welcome you to Health Styles.
Thank you, Barbara.
The role of nurse practitioners as primary care providers is not new, but it seems that the awareness of what nurse practitioners do and their role in the healthcare system is becoming more of a topical conversation with healthcare reform and the Patient and Affordable Care Act, or what we know as healthcare reform. Will you help our listeners, just sort of in the beginning of our conversation, Eileen, understand what the nurse practitioner's education and role is in primary care, and maybe link it to why in the Affordable Care Act and healthcare reform their role will be increasing?
Great. Thanks, of course, Barbara. Yeah, there's a huge opportunity now since the constitutionality of the mandate was upheld. And so we're seeing nurse practitioners are often earning doctoral degrees now, but they mostly all have master's degrees. And it's, you become an RN, and then you go through a graduate program where you're educated and trained to take care of the range of primary care problems. And we're seeing nurse practitioners being a nimble workforce where we are able to go into acute care, end-of-life care, pediatrics, the whole spectrum of healthcare delivery. We're seeing more nurse practitioners because we can produce them faster and the education is becoming of higher quality. So we are seeing a huge surge of interest and demand because the Affordable Care Act really stresses patient engagement in a more fierce way, that we're trying to move away from this medical model with this patriarch model with the expert physician as all-knowing, but really more of a partnership in getting patients to look at their own lifestyle, look at what they're doing to allow themselves to host chronic illness.
I think it's interesting for our listeners to understand what you mean by primary care and also the vision of what primary care can become from it only being a sickness model, or many people still, even though in their own personal experience, may find themselves going for whether it's an annual checkup or because they're feeling under the weather, and only seeing an interface with a clinician as being one that's based on acute care. What's the vision of nurse practitioners and your vision about where we can go in terms of reversing that model or changing it up completely?
Yes, great question. So moving away from that sickness model to a much more prevention model, population-based model, so that we can look at, we know what a lot of risk factors are for most chronic illnesses, and look at preventing that illness from taking hold. So we're looking at, for example, this new healthcare home model where you go to a place where they all know you, it's one-stop shopping, and it's very much prevention-based. And that's what we want to move to, so that you don't wait until you're in ICU to get care. That you when you start to get symptoms, or even before you're symptomatic, when your blood values might be showing that you're going down the wrong direction, where we intervene way earlier than we do now.
We know that the Affordable Care Act is imperfect, and certainly it doesn't mean that all peoples living in the United States will have access to care. But what it does mean is that more people will be covered by care. But there are many places that nurse practitioners are currently practicing where the model is already different, and I mean that in terms of mini clinics, nurse practitioner-run centers, places where it's more affordable and perhaps more accessible in communities, not only in cities but in rural areas and across the country.
Yes, no question about it. That's our nimbleness, going into areas where there isn't perhaps a workforce. So we're seeing more creative solutions, and these convenient care centers are wildly popular, although they have a very restricted set of services that they provide. They're really taking care of a lot of needs very quickly and efficiently and cost effectively.
I was actually had to had to change my own view after doing some research and seeing that there are a number of studies, including two by the RAND Corporation, looking at not only the effectiveness clinically and economically, but comparatively to primary care physicians' practices, where the referral patterns of nurse practitioners in these kinds of centers were equal to, if not better, than a primary care practice. And referrals, what we mean by that is when someone arrives and perhaps they need a more interventionist attention or specialty, that the referral patterns are equal to, if not better, again, in the primary care model. And I think a lot of people, like my own biases, thought, what does this mean if Target or Walmart or any one of the private corporations are starting to build a system of healthcare, of primary care, how could it possibly be as good? And in fact, the research shows that they're moving and providing care that is equal to, in many ways, a primary care physician's office.
Absolutely. And there's not a single study to say otherwise, that the care is inferior in any way. And a lot of what we see in primary care is gray. There's a lot of watchful waiting. We're not really sure what to do. And that really hinges on having a relationship. So if you go into an emergency room for a primary care problem, you're not likely to have any trusting relationship and do some watchful waiting. Let's see what happens in a couple days. See if it gets better. You're not willing to do that. So to me, the container of the relationship is the key here over time.
Now, I mentioned in my introduction that in addition to your work as a professor at Pace University in the nurse practitioner program teaching the wellness coaching model as well as health policy, that you publish a column in Nurse Practitioner World News. What kinds of policy issues are you writing about recently?
Well, just looking at the access issues, certainly as an issue that we all care about, every single one of us is impacted by this. And what's going to happen when 32 million people are swept into the system over the next few years? As this ACA, Affordable Care Act, is rolled out and the mandate is in place, that, you know, what we saw happen in Massachusetts, because this model is really scaled on that, was they had huge workforce shortages and they were not prepared. And I'm not seeing too much planning going on in terms of what's going to happen here. So we're expecting a huge surge in demand, perhaps some waits, and nurse practitioners are really being looked at now to fill in some of that gap.
How many nurse practitioners are there in the United States?
Well, there's about 200,000 plus or minus 10,000 or so. We don't have an exact count. So we have about 200,000, and it's a really growing, rapidly growing profession.
And their enrollment in most of the nurse practitioner schools is quite high. As
yes, in fact, we're not able to keep up with the demand. And even at the RN level, something like 30,000 qualified nursing students were turned away because it's very expensive and labor-intensive to train nurses. It's not like a political science degree. There's a lot of one-on-one supervision and all kinds of licensing requirements.
You know, up until even recently, a young woman that I know who's a new mom now, her child's probably close to a year and a half, was in a busy practice where she took her son for his pediatric well care and mentioned to me that she really prefers to see the woman who's in the practice. And I asked her, is she a pediatrician also? Or is she a nurse practitioner? And she said, gee, you know, I don't really know. I just know that not only my family, but everyone I know prefers to see her. And I said, well, why don't you check it out? And in fact, she came back and said to me, you know, she's a pediatric nurse practitioner. And I think one of the things, and why I'm also glad that my guest on Health Styles is Eileen O'Grady, who is a certified nurse practitioner and a wellness coach. We'll talk about that in just a moment. She's practiced primary care for over two decades and teaches here at Pace University in the nurse practitioner program. And we're talking about the role of nurse practitioners, and we'll be talking about this integrative model of nurse practitioners who are also wellness coaches and where that fits in the movement going forward in our country, where we will be doing more prevention, more public health, and helping our communities be healthier through their resiliency and ability to make small changes with supportive healthcare system, as opposed to only interfacing when one is not well. And so I think it's interesting that people would see practitioners and the practitioner either isn't identifying his or herself very clearly, or that in our busy lives we miss that. So for those of you who are listening, when you're engaged in a healthcare encounter, it's your right to know not only the person's name, but their full credentials so that you can know who's taking care of you in that moment.
Absolutely. That's very important. And there has been some pushback about, you know, as nurses are earning doctorates in nursing, about how that's going to cause clinical confusion for patients. So it's really important. For the most part, nurse practitioners are on a first-name basis with providers. Again, with patients, breaking down that wall, that hierarchy. So that's usually a clue in, but you should absolutely know who you're talking to and who you're getting care from. And I have found over three decades that working with nurse practitioners, it's such an easy sell. Patients are somewhat skeptical, and then they go and see what it's really like, the patient education, the warmth, the relationship, the caring, all that nursing coming to the fore is really very popular with people.
I recently was able to finally find a geriatric nurse practitioner for my parents, who are 88 and 87 in Florida where they live, and they couldn't be happier. So I can speak from it not only professionally as a public health nurse and a nurse, but to tell you that my search for my parents took a while because, unfortunately, in the community they lived in, there weren't enough. And now, fortunately, they're engaged with a wonderful geriatric nurse practitioner. But let's now talk about this wellness coach. You are a wellness coach. And for our listeners, what does that mean? And what does it mean with the depth of your multiple degrees, including your doctorate, your degrees in nursing and public health, and your over two-decade experience as a clinician? Why wellness coaching, and what has it done for you as a professional nurse practitioner, certified nurse practitioner, and the way that you are practicing today?
Yeah. Well, part of it was spending two decades writing prescriptions and fistfuls of them for people that came in with hypertension, elevated cholesterol, lots of obesity, depression, and all nurse practitioners have prescriptive privileges in all 50 states. And I found over time that it was really not the truth, that I didn't have enough time in these 10 or 15 minute visits, the way the primary care setting I was in was set up, to really get at what was really needed in their life. And that was some kind of lifestyle change, some kind of raised awareness, consciousness about what they were doing, what they were allowing into their bodies. So I just could not go back to that practice. And I kept trying to find a community of people that felt the same way, that the pharmaceutical industry was really the only tool we had. And certainly effective and powerful, and we need pharmaceuticals to mitigate the effects of chronic illness and all illness, but it was the only thing we had. And I didn't actually have the skills or the tools to really talk people off the ledge and change their lifestyle. So I finally searched and searched, and I found a community of people, and it's the coaching community. And they really come from HR, human resources, and executive coaching. And it's taking those skill sets, very specific skills about getting people to motivate towards change, and using this in the health arena.
Give me some clear examples. Let's do a scenario. I'm a woman who comes to your practice. I have parents who both suffer from hypertension. One of them is lives with diabetes. I'm moving towards being 50 pounds overweight. I'm not exercising. My diet could be helped, and all I live with is a fear that I'm next. What would you do for me?
Yes. Well, it starts with a conversation, and really understanding the change cycle and any change process. This is an evidence-based process. We all start in resistance. If you think about any change you've made in your life, you're in resistance. And then slowly that gets chipped away, and then you move into contemplation. You're thinking about a change, but you're not sure you can do it or that you want to do it. And the problem with contemplation is you can hang there for decades.
Yes, we know that.
So you're in contemplation, and then something happens. Somebody dies. There's some kind of deep fear. Maybe you saw a picture of yourself. Something happens where you say, I can't do this anymore. You move into preparation, action, maintenance, and relapse, and it's a circle, and it goes around and around. So for each of those different phases of change, there are different interventions. And what I see going on in the medical model is everyone's getting treatment as if they're in action, as if they are ready to receive the information and they need advice. So one of the tenets of the coaching model is we don't give advice. We make suggestions and we ask first if we can, but we really think of it as an experience of mining the answers from the patient themselves, that they actually know the truth, and it's an excavation project to get it out of them. So there's not a single person on this planet that doesn't know that tobacco is carcinogenic. So if you start launching into that with someone in resistance, you dig them deeper into resistance and make it worse.
So what would you do?
So I would start asking what you want. So create some vision. What do you want? Ask powerful questions. What would it be like if you didn't have this 50 pounds on you? What would your life be like? And you start talking very positively and using change talk. That's what we're trying to elicit. So I'm not going to impose what I want for you onto you. I'm asking you what you want. And then over time, and once you can describe a vision of where you want to be in a year, then I start asking you what you're really hungry for. So if you're emotional eating, there's something you're hungry for in your life, perhaps. Or maybe you're doing nighttime eating. Lots of women aren't eating enough calories during the day and they're binging at night. So I'd start to ask, you know, and a great question to ask anyone that's overweight is, why are you overweight? And they can tell you inside of 15 seconds. They know exactly what the problem behavior is. So then it becomes a question of, what are you really hungry for? Is there something missing from your life? So it has nothing to do with food, and rarely do I talk about food at all. So once we get at what's getting in the way, then we start creating goals. And once your awareness is raised, I mean, oftentimes it is not enough calories during the day. Once your awareness is raised, when we start to move to goals, which I have the patient create themselves, they say them out loud. That is the beginning of the change process, to say things out loud you've never said before and to tell another human being what your goal is. And you're not allowed to agree to a goal with me unless it's at least a 7 out of 10 chance that you can be successful.
Oh.
So it's baby steps and it's success. So we don't set you up for failure, and these little tiny changes over time have profound impact. So I'm convinced that people do not need help with knowledge. That is not the answer. It is not the solution. We're in an information overload. We need support and help through the change process.
So the word non-compliant doesn't come up in a coaching relationship?
It's been banished completely. And it's resistance.
One of my least favorite words in healthcare.
It's resistance. And I can feel, even when I was looking at this coaching model, I thought, I have 3 graduate degrees. I am done. I'm not going back to school. And I was absolutely resistant. Any change I've made in my life, I always start there. And it gets chipped away at over time.
You mentioned it's evidence-based. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes, that there's this model, the Prochaska change model, has been used on addicts and alcoholics, and it's a very predictable pattern, and you listen for words when they're in change. When you start to hear ambivalence, what you have people do is to say, well, what will happen if you don't change and you stay the same? And what will happen if you do change? And they make 2 lists, and then they circle the things that are most important to them. So you sort of help them tip the decisional balance. So it's not just floating around in their head. It becomes very clear that perhaps moving in that direction is the thing for them to do. Now, when someone's in resistance, and this, you know, those of you out there that have teenagers face this a lot, it's really important to just agree with them. Yeah, I see. I get it. Smoking is really pleasurable for you. And I see how it absents you from conflict. When there's a conflict in the family, you get up and walk out and have a cigarette. And I can see what an important role that plays for you. And then that's it. You don't have to say anything else. And that way they're not pushing against you, but they're left feeling like they're in control of the process. Because I really think that people don't like to be told what to do. They much prefer to get there on their own, that they're very resistant to be given advice. And I don't like to get advice when I'm not interested in changing. It's hurtful to me. It's offensive.
So I mentioned in my role of this a mock patient who is arrived to your practice, or I'm on the phone with you, which I want to ask you about, which is that I have a tremendous, I'm living with a fear that's paralyzing me to move forward, knowing that I have a family history and a higher potential incidence of having this cardiac and diabetes health issue. And so what would you do with my fear? What should I do with my fear?
Right. Well, first of all, when we live a fear-driven life, we're very, very confined. And so that has to be addressed and put a spotlight on it right away. We don't make good decisions for ourselves when we're in fear. You know, it's really a lot of ego-driven fear, and it's not healthy. So part of it is that I don't think that anybody should ever have to stay stuck in self-defeating behavior. And we see it all over the place. And there's just absolutely no reason for it. That it's treatable. You can get help. You can get support by taking one step. So I would ask you, what's troubling you the most of all these things you've brought up? It's the weight. It's the blood pressure. What's troubling you the most? And what are you willing to do? What actions are you? If you say yes to a healthy lifestyle, what are you willing to say no to? So that yes, no question. And that you absolutely really a partnership statement. You don't have to be alone in this. You don't have to feel alone. You can have support through the change process. And this, it is very difficult for us to change. If you think about a toddler learning how to walk, and that's the visual I like to use. When a toddler falls down, we don't say, never mind, you'll never do it again. We are encouraging, get up, get up. We want them to move forward, and we expect them to fall. And it's the same with any kind of lifestyle change we're making as adults.
Well, why do you say, or not just you, but why do people in the coaching world say this is not therapy?
Because we're not focused on the past. So I'm not a trained therapist, so I don't really have to worry about doing therapy because I don't even know how to do it. I'm not trained as a therapist. And in the coaching model, we're really designing your preferred future. We are not focused on why you're eating the entire box of Oreo cookies. We're focused on what do you want in your future, the present and the future. So therapy is more going back and looking at the why question, and that doesn't interest us at all. We're looking at the what do you want in the future. So there is some crossover with cognitive behavioral therapy, for sure, but we're not at all focused on the past, and the only time we bring the past up is when you've had a huge success. So, for example, I was coaching a woman who said that she was very afraid of quitting her job. She had a lot of investment in it. She was very fearful about it, and I asked her when she had been brave in her life, and she remembered she left a guy at the altar when she was 18 or 19 who ended up being a very end-stage alcoholic. So there was some intuitive sense in her that she was a survivor and knew how to take care of herself, and nobody at the time supported her. So that was a huge act of bravery. And she'd forgotten that. And so we brought that scenario into the current situation that she was, in fact, a brave woman. And she was very quickly able to resign from this toxic job she was in.
I mentioned a question that I want to ask you now, which is that I know that wellness coaches, and I know that your practice includes doing coaching by telephone. How effective is that, and is that part of a successful model for this practice of coaching?
Absolutely. I'm finding my clients are all over the country, and I was Skyping with somebody in Europe even, and I'm finding that the premise here is that in order to really change, we have to start saying things out loud, often that we've never said out loud before. And so when you don't have eye contact with somebody, you're much more likely to be honest. So it's a lot like phone sex, which I've never had, where people are saying things out loud they've never said before to another human being. And it's safe, and that I'm an absolute stranger, and that really helps. So I can't really coach people I love and care about because I can't be neutral on the agenda. So I absolutely, it's a safe place to deposit anything you want to say out loud, non-judgmentally, and then we can start digging towards the truth. So the phone works beautifully, and it's incredibly convenient for people. They really like it, doing it from their home, or some people go down to their garage in their office, or they close their door at the office. It's really convenient, and it's more affordable than therapy, and it's much more short-term.
I want to make sure that we cover the topic of the group coaching model, because I see it as the future in many ways of the work that you're involved in and others who understand the power of group. Will you address that as a coach and as a nurse practitioner?
Yes, absolutely. So when I was in primary care practice, I found like I was a broken record saying the same thing over and over again, giving the same information that people were not receptive to over and over and over again. And also, I don't have the lived experience of having diabetes. So I think it's quite powerful to have, new diabetics, 8 or 10 at a conference table and using each other to support each other, because I don't really know what that's like. So you don't feel so alone in your disease. And it's also very motivating. So if somebody gets their blood levels down or gets off their meds, that's going to motivate you more than me telling you what to do. And I think we need to move away from this Marcus Welby approach that we have, where it's one-on-one. It's not working. I think it's fair to say it's not working.
How can people find out more about your practice, Eileen?
I have a website, www.eileenogrady.net.
Thank you so much for joining me. My guest was Eileen O'Grady. She has a PhD. She's a nurse certified nurse practitioner and wellness coach. She's been in practice in primary care for over 2 decades, currently holds a professorship at Pace University in the School of Nurse as a nurse practitioner instructor. And you can learn more about her at EileenO'Grady.net. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Barbara. Delightful to be here.
This is Barbara Glickstein. You've been tuned into Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. Find out more about us at CenterForHealthMediaPolicy.com. Thank you, and stay tuned.